This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So we're going to do our final meeting of this series on the Eightfold Path and focusing on right concentration, which is also samadhi. Each of these sessions is, I hope has been valuable. I think that it's been important to do this. It's also, in a sense, a beginning or just, an opportunity to come together and look at each of these aspects of the Eightfold Path. Each of these, if anything, I hope what's become clear is that each of these requires continued study. Each of these is much larger than we can possibly, take up in the time that we've had. And this is particularly true with right concentration. But it still has value. So what I wanted to do is start first with just reading a few words from the Piyarasi Thera and Bhikkhu Bodhi on their comments and some of the quotes of the Buddha that they've included in their books. And so some of this will be familiar to you. Piyarasi quotes the Buddha in asking the question or responding to the question, what is concentration? And he responds that whatever is unification of mind, this is concentration. So if we think of the experience, the universal experience of the lack of unification of mind, we call that distraction, scatteredness, the mind appearing as being fragmented, diffused. And so when the mind is concentrated, it's unified. When it's unified, it's in a state of concentration. He says the four arousings of mindfulness are the marks of concentration. So we spoke about this in our last session, the foundations of mindfulness, body, breathing, feelings, emotions, mental objects, and various mental states, mind and mind objects. And so he says those are the marks of concentration, those are the things we're turning our attention to or concentrating on. The four right efforts are requisite for concentration. In other words, in order to turn our attention to any object and develop concentration, arise extending out of our mindfulness, we have to be developing right effort, which we spoke about the session before. And then he said, whatever is the exercise, the development, the increase of these very things, this is the development of concentration. And so he's making clear, making clear the connection between effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And this also extends to the previous aspects of right understanding, right intention, in terms of developing initially conceptual understanding, developing and understanding how to use our mind in terms of our thinking and our thoughts and our intentions, and then into speech, action, and livelihood, how we're actually living, what we're doing, because that creates karma, which is arising out of our understanding thoughts and our mindfulness or lack of, and is also impacting that in turn. So it's a cyclical process. He talks about, I thought it was interesting, he mentions the two teachers that the Buddha studied with, Alada Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta. And as you remember, he went in, these were two very prominent teachers who had sanghas of their own, and the Buddha went to study with each of them in turn, and each of them basically taught the Buddha what they had to teach, and the Buddha accomplished what they had to teach, and each of them invited the Buddha to basically share in the leadership of those respective sanghas, in saying that they had, that he had experienced and accomplished what they had accomplished. And the Buddha declined, recognizing that although he had experienced certain states of meditation, that he was not yet liberated. And the point that Piyadasi makes is that what they had developed and taught him was basically deep states of what Buddhism calls absorption. And that those are, that is a meditative experience that is common in the world of meditation. And it makes sense that that would be so, that any meditator, I mean, it's, it seems, would recognize the agitation of the mind and the relationship of that with the various things coming in through the senses, and the agitation, the turmoil, the turbulence of that, and the need to quiet and calm. And so it's, I think it's what most people think of as meditation, and what many people are seeking in meditation is that, that calming of the mind, which we speak of as shamatha. And so he makes the point that that's not exclusively Buddhist, but it is only a part of the Buddhist path and the Buddhist understanding of what is necessary and important in the meditative process. He also defines vipassana. So shamatha and vipassana are the two aspects of Buddha's meditation, so calming the mind and insight. And the vipassana, its derivation means to see in a particular way, or to see, as he says, to see in an extraordinary way, or in a non-ordinary way, we might say. And so it's a very particular kind of seeing. And seeing here doesn't negate sight or any of the senses, but it's not exclusively in the realm of the senses. And that's why, in a sense, shamatha or calming meditation or absorption meditation is much more accessible. I mean, anybody who meditates regularly and sincerely will certainly have moments or extended moments. And if you meditate regularly and deeply, you will experience that more and more as a normal state, as just a normal state of mind, a normal state of being. In the beginning, it's very fickle. You know, it comes and goes. It goes more than it comes, often in the beginning. But with time, that becomes more of one's normal state of mind. So that's much easier, even though it's challenging, it's much easier. And it's easier because it's something that you can direct your mind to and do. Whereas insight, meditation, or vipassana has aspects in which we can turn our attention to and direct our mind towards, but ultimately it has to go beyond that. Piyadasi also says that the development of vipassana or penetrative insight combines with tranquilizing concentration or calming meditation, and each functions in a way that is codependent. They depend on each other. He says that if you overdo the insight, the emphasis on insight, then particularly through analytic meditation, and that's something we need to speak about a little bit, then that can, he says, there can be flurry. In other words, that can lead to an overly active aspect of state of mind. And yet, if there's too much emphasis on calming, that can lead to a kind of indolence or a dullness or a quietude that is calming but not transformative. Okay. Any questions or comments just thus far? Sancho, hang on a second. We got people on line here.
You know, you talked about the two teachers that he studied with, and I often wondered how he knew that there was more, the Buddha. You know, I mean, he had attained these higher states of enlightenment, and I think to most people, if they had attained those states, they would have thought, well, this is it, you know? But he knew that there was something more, and I don't know. How did you think that he knew that?
Well, I mean, what he said, was that he knew that he was not yet liberated because what he experienced in those states of meditation were dependent upon that meditation. So he knew that what he was seeking was a liberation that was not dependent on anything. That's the significance of the First Noble Truth, that all conditioned things are dukkha. Anything that is created will come apart. So any state of mind, even in a deep state of meditation, as we all experience, changes, right? It's not a permanent state. And so if you're dependent upon that state for what you take as liberation, then you're dependent, right? You're not really free yet because that state cannot be preserved.
But he, you know, I wonder when he got to that state, why didn't he think, well, this is it for everybody?
Yeah, well, I think
even though he recognized that.
Particularly being recognized by these two prominent teachers. You know, I think a lot of us would think, okay, well, if you say I've experienced liberation, then I must be. This must be it. And I think that was part of his own brilliance, genius as a spiritual being. But you know, in smaller ways, more humble ways, you know, practitioners, you know, when students do koans, for instance, and they work on a koan and they pass that koan, the teacher says, yes, you've had insight into that koan. And the student has questions within themselves, right? They don't feel clear or fully clear, or they have doubts. There are a couple of possibilities. One is that the teacher's not clear. And so, you know, I've talked to a lot of students over the years who've come from other centers who have left those centers or teachers because their teacher was passing them on koans, and they realize, I am not seeing these. What I'm experiencing cannot be insight into these koans because they still don't understand them, right? And so that's one possibility. And the other possibility is that they have had insight and it's not yet fully clear. And so that's where trusting oneself as well as trusting one's teacher is important. And over time, you know, kind of working that out. I mean, there were koans that I worked on with Dada Roshi where he passed me and I didn't feel satisfied with him. And so I would come back and work on it again with him, you know, and would continue to work on my own because I felt like I needed more, I wanted more understanding than I felt like I had. You know, the part of the teacher's view is their understanding also that this moment of insight can be genuine and authentic, but there's more. And so the student needs to continue. And the teacher has that view, right? So they're able to sort of put this moment of insight for the student's experience into a larger context, because they know if the student keeps training, that this will become more clear. I mean, think about just in a intellectual way, when you're studying something in school, right? And you do well on a test, and at the same time know that you're not really yet fully comfortable with the subject, right? And both are true. You know, you have sufficient understanding at this moment to do well on the test, and you need to keep going, right, if you want to really gain proficiency in that subject.
Roshi, could you comment on a little bit on the relationship between shamatha and vipassana? So if we were to just sit by ourselves and meditate regularly, calming the mind would probably occur. But does insight naturally occur along with calming the mind, or is that where training becomes so important?
Yes.
So you really cannot cultivate insight without a training teacher.
I wouldn't say it's not possible, but because the sort of our conceptual mind is so powerful and so well habituated, you know, so it's so reflexive that what a lot of it is happening in developing mindfulness and the calming, the shamatha, is developing the capacity to then use that mind and direct it in a way where there's still a conceptual element, right? You're directing your mind. There's still a sense of someone directing your meditation in a particular way, but you're able to do that in a way that isn't activating a lot of intellection, right? And so you're developing a foundation by which you can actually work with your mind in a conscious way that begins to bring different levels, different kinds of insight, and different insight into different aspects of yourself and your mind and the Dharma. And that as that deepens, and this is really what we need to be getting to, as that deepens, there's, in a sense, stages in which that is happening such that then you leap free of that directed, conscious, conceptual aspect. I mean, think of the beginning of the Genjo Koan. When all dharmas are Buddha dharmas, there's life and death, delusion and enlightenment, ordinary beings and Buddhas, and practice. When dharmas are without self, right, then there's no life and death, there's no Buddhas and creatures, and he doesn't mention practice, right? But going beyond being and non-being, right, there's life and death, Buddhas and creatures, he also doesn't mention practice, right? So something is falling away. Something is falling away. In fact, all along the way, different aspects are falling away in terms of being released from our consciousness, being in a sense liberated from our consciousness. And that leap into non-conceptual insight is, in a sense, that more ultimate leap, that more ultimate letting go. So let's go on so we can actually get into that. So Bhikkhu Bodhi says concentration represents an intensification of a mental factor present in every state of consciousness. So what we're developing isn't something new, right? It's present in every moment of consciousness, but it can be very weak. It can be very dim. It can be very fragile, right? Which is why we experience our distractedness. But it's there. And so what, and in fact, all of this is here, right? We're not creating anything that's new. We're not bringing forth anything that we don't already possess. We're just strengthening and bringing into our awareness all of these aspects that we have that we need in order to free ourselves. He also says that samadhi is only a particular kind of one-pointedness. One-pointed concentration is another way of speaking about samadhi. He says it's not equivalent to one-pointedness in its entirety. And then he goes on to describe that they're a gourmet sitting down to a meal, an assassin about to slay their victim, a soldier on the battlefield, could all be in a state of concentration. But their concentration wouldn't be characterized as samadhi because samadhi is exclusively wholesome. It has a moral element, right? We talked about this a little bit last time with mindfulness in terms of the wholesome or unwholesome mindfulness, right? And so he's, I think, clarifying that point here. So as the commentaries define samadhi as the centering of the mind and mental factors rightly and evenly on an object. Samadhi is wholesome concentration, collects together the ordinarily dispersed and dissipated stream of mental states to induce an inner unification. And so we are training the mind, but what's important to appreciate is that we're training it to, in a sense, to reclaim a natural capacity that we all have. And that we experience in different moments when we're in a state of concentration, right? And one of the important elements of this is that the power of this is coming from you. And so if you're captured by something, like a movie, right, and you're really in it, that's, you could speak of as a state of concentration, but it's not samadhi from a Buddhist perspective because it's not really under your own power. I mean, you're a willing participant, right? If you're not into a movie, then you're not, then you're going to be distracted. But as soon as the movie's over, the state of that degree of concentration departs. And what we're trying to do is really develop that such that it doesn't come and go, right? Not that it's permanent, but that it's more your ongoing ordinary state. He says concentration can be developed through either of two practices, either as the goal of a system of practice directed expressly towards the attainment of deep concentration, the level of absorption. So that's sort of a key word that's used in terms of absorption meditation. So that's a particular kind of way of working with your mind and a way of sort of developing your meditation. Or is the incidental accompaniment of the path intended to generate insight. And so in this way, concentration can be the purpose be to calm the mind and experience a deep state of absorption, which means a very focused, concentrated state of mind that is usually focused on an object, like the breath. And as it deepens and deepens and deepens into absorption, the sense of self and other and time and things drops away. And so in a state of deep absorption, there's no self-awareness, right? So when you, if you have a period of zazen where time passes very quickly and you're not just spacing out or daydreaming, that's more entering into a state of absorption, okay? So that's an important, a valid state of concentration, and it's not sufficient in and of itself to free us. Because going back to this issue of these other two teachers the Buddha studied with, it comes and goes, right? I mean, even if it's a more stable aspect of your mind and you live within more and more a state of concentration, it's not turning over our delusion. It's not transforming the illusions that we have about self and other and the world. And so he says the other stream or the other path is where that state of concentration is being used, applied toward generating insight, realization, seeing into the nature of things. And he says for both of these, moral discipline must be purified. In other words, we have to be living rightly, not causing harm, practicing good, actualizing good for others. The various impediments, all the various things that obstruct us, get in the way, that turn us around, must be severed or seen through. The meditator must seek out suitable instruction, preferably from a teacher, a personal teacher, which means there's a one-on-one contact, and must resort to a dwelling conducive to practice. So these are sort of the basic ingredients of what have always been considered kind of the important things to have on the path, that we're living our life in accord with the precepts, we're getting instruction, and we're finding environments in which to practice that are conducive. So then he talks about the various objects. There are 40 traditional objects that the Buddha described as being suitable for developing your concentration. And the sort of most primary and common and traditional is the breath. Right? And so in the first foundation of mindfulness, it is the body foundation, the foundation of the body, mindfulness of the body is the mindfulness of the breath. But he goes on to describe other kinds of objects, and he describes them here as there are 10 kasinas, and kasinas is a Sanskrit word which basically refers to different kinds of objects. And so there are objects that relate to the elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And so in the Visuddhimagga, in the interest of time, I won't read from that. It's quite interesting, and it's very detailed. So there are pages and pages of how to construct an object. So there's a lot of detail about constructing an earth kasina, which is basically made out of clay. And the size of it is specified. The distance it is from you is specified. It's very detailed. And then there are other objects that can be used relating to different the different elements, earth, air, fire, and water. There's also light and space kasina, so there are different ways of sort of turning your attention to an object that is based in light and space. And these objects then you bring your attention to and you focus on them. You concentrate on them, right? And they are an object, so your eyes are open and you're focusing on them as an external object. That's where it begins, and then it moves on from there. And there's also details about what objects might be suitable for you. So which of these 40 objects might be suitable for you, depending on your temperament, depending on your inclinations, depending on, you know, what would be skillful. And then there are the 10 recollections. And here, 10 unattractive objects. And so corpses are in different states of decomposition of corpses. And he mentions that in mindfulness, there is a mindfulness practice of sitting in the presence of a decomposing corpse, which is really based in reflection. So you're using that as a way to reflect on impermanence and to kind of divest oneself of our attachment to the sense of this as being this, you know, sort of to break the enchantment, you know, that we have with the body by seeing into like what it's made of, what's inside of it, you know, that our skin sort of conceals. To see impermanence actually happening, right? And as goes this, so goes this. So really to make it real, you know, that this sense that, you know, this is who I am and all of the attachment that comes along with that. But that in the development of concentration, that it's really just being used as an object of concentration. So you're not doing reflection, you're just focusing on it. Then there are 10 recollections, which begin with the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And again, in Buddhaghosa, in this Visuddhimagga, which is this really ancient core text, there's pages and pages of how to use the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, respectively, as an object of meditation. So a lot of this is, most of it is, you know, reflecting on bringing into mind the various good qualities of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so you can also think of the skillfulness of that, right? Because you're both developing your concentration, but you're doing that in a very, very, very particular way, right? So you're sort of cultivating a particular relationship with these excellent qualities of Buddha, of Dharma and Sangha. So what is that doing, right? It's like bringing you closer. It's bringing it inside of you. It's making it very real, not abstract. And then there's, as a continuing of the 10 recollections, there's meditating on morality, on virtue, being virtuous, on good virtues, on generosity, and on divine-like qualities. So it's sort of relating to, you might think of the qualities of the bodhisattvas who embody perfect wisdom, perfect compassion, perfect manifestation of enlightenment, Samantabhadra, and you're identifying those within yourself. But remember that all of these are concentration practices, right? So you're actually using these so that as you're reflecting on these qualities, that means you have to hold those aspects in your mind. And then when your mind gets distracted and it breaks apart, you have to bring it back and reestablish that quality. And then there's some more. And then the next category is the immeasurables, the four immeasurables. And so there you're meditating on loving kindness, on compassion, on sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So you're really using these as objects of meditation. And again, if you think about the, there's a neutral quality to meditating with the breath, which is part of its power, right? It's not complicated, and yet how complicated it can become, right? Here you're using as a focus of your concentration something that has qualities, right? So when you're meditating on loving kindness, you're bringing forth those qualities within yourself, which is strengthening them. When you're meditating on alleviating suffering or compassion, you're strengthening that within your consciousness, right? You're bringing forth those qualities and making them stronger within yourself. So you can see there's a concentration element, there's also a transformational element, right? You're strengthening those within yourself. And then there are four immaterial states, which are, and you see this a lot referred to in the teachings, the original teachings, and these are the base of infinite space, of infinite consciousness, of infinite, the base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And we don't have time to go into all of these, and obviously in our tradition, we approach Zazen or meditation in a different way, right? So this is a very detailed, there's kind of a linear quality to this, a very clearly specified and sort of a kind of didactic aspect to this, which is has a very tangible quality to it. Whereas in the Zen tradition, you're hard-pressed to actually find even instruction in meditation. So what's that about, right? In this meditation school, just jhana school of Buddhism, right? Remember when the Buddha talks about this development of concentration as the four jhanas, right? Chan is a transliteration of jhana. So there's this very strong sort of putting at the very center the practice of Zazen, sitting jhana, sitting Zen, sitting meditation, and this very unique, kind of unusual relationship with the teaching of that meditation. I was looking at a Mahamudra teaching in which it said, it referred to these four immaterial states. And the teacher said, when we meditate on the nature of mind as being inseparable, as being the same as empty space, as being without boundaries, So again, this is a meditation where you're meditating on the nature of mind as being boundless. He says this leads you to the samadhi of infinite space.
The samadhi of what?
When you, he says, when you meditate on the nature of mind as being identical with infinite space or spaciousness, boundarylessness, that leads you to the samadhi of infinite space. When you regard consciousness as being boundless as a cosmic state, this can lead, so now you're directing your attention to consciousness. This can lead to the samadhi of infinite consciousness. When you think emptiness means that nothing exists, this leads to the samadhi of nothingness. So now you're directing, in a sense, you're directing your attention to emptiness itself. So how is that, right? And then when we think emptiness means, or when we're really meditating with the understanding that emptiness means neither existence nor non-existence, this leads to the samadhi of neither existence nor non-existence. So this is a much more subtle form of practice where the object itself is objectless, right? So this would only be possible after a fairly developed state of concentration was already in available. And then he goes on to say that in terms of beginning, that the subject generally recommended for its effectiveness in clearing the mind of stray thoughts is mindfulness of breathing. And that really is the key practice. I mean, that's the essential practice that really includes everything, in which everything is present. Okay, so I know I'm moving quickly through all of this, but I wanted to try at least touch on these various things, also to bring out a little bit of the language and the terms so that there's some more familiarity with just what these terms mean.
It's probably
a very basic question, because I feel like this comes up in Zen practice for me and always has, of the concentration on a object or a koan, falling into created states of some kind,
mm-hmm.
and then what to do with them. It's usually do I chase them away or do I just sort of let it play itself out? I feel like it's in a sense, I've picked up some confusion about what to do with those states, what to do with blissful feeling or a sort of ferocious feeling or some strong way that I'm feeling like, okay, this is good? Or sometimes it just feels like, no, this is not good.
Yeah.
This is like I'm getting
to actually answer your question, let's keep looking at this. But what I would say, what I have done over the years in studying this, is, you know, my belief, my faith, and my conviction is that everything that is being taught in this particular way is present and necessary in our practice as well, right? We're not doing something different, right? It's one path, it's one Dharma, and that these teachings, you know, particularly within the meditation-based schools of Buddhism, that exist within the Theravada tradition, that exists within some of the schools of Tibetan Buddhism, all of them to different degrees in terms of their emphasis on meditation, and then within our own tradition, that why I think it's important to study this and become familiar with it is so that you can reflect on how are you experiencing these elements in your own practice. That you may be not bringing them into your practice consciously in the same way, in the very sort of directed stage by stage way that they might be taken up in the, in other traditions. But the same things that are being encountered, you're encountering. If you're meditating, you're encountering them. And if you're developing your meditation, it's developing in the same ways. Okay? It's being pointed to in a different way. Right? So in these teachings, it's very, let's lay it out. And that, you know, that's, there's a satisfying quality to that, because there's a sense of, okay, this is what I do, and this is what happens. And that's also its danger. Right? This is what I do, so it, something starts to become solidified and reified and objectified in my mind, and this is what happens. Right? And it's not that that's going to be absent with a different style of teaching. We're going to do the same thing, but we're being given less to grab onto. And so, for instance, you know, how does Dogen speak of samadhi? Right? The same thing that's being spoken of here. He's in his fascicle on ocean mudra samadhi. And there, because one of the things about samadhi, about concentration, is that there are different understandings in different traditions and even in different teachers within different traditions about the relationship between shamatha and vipassana, between calming the mind and insight. And the understanding about what is that relationship and how dependent are they on each other? And even what is samadhi? I mean, there are basic understandings that are common, I think, in all the schools, and yet there are different differences as well. So the Dogen says, elements come together and form this body. At the time of appearing, elements appear. At the time of disappearing, elements disappear. When elements appear, I do not say, I appear. When elements disappear, I do not say, I disappear. Past moments and future moments do not arise in sequence. Past elements and future elements are not in alignment. This is the meaning of ocean mudra samadhi. So those of you who have studied the teachings of the Majjhimaka Nagarjuna, he's speaking about that right here. In terms of what we're going to talk about in a minute, he's speaking about that right here. And he's speaking about it both poetically and very try to grab onto this way. In other words, it's kind of like a haiku. You know, where in a haiku, if you want to talk about winter, you can't say winter, right? Because that kills it, right? Rather, you speak about it in such a way that it gives you the sense of it. It pulls you in so that with your mind, you're bringing forth that experience that is being offered in the haiku. And that's made possible when the haiku doesn't define it, right? It's more allusion. It's pointing at it indirectly. And in that way, when we're ripe, we don't just understand it, but we know it in a different way. And that's, I think, a really important characteristic of the teaching of Zen, right? Is it's trying to draw us in, not give it to us, right? And so he goes on to talk about these stages of concentration, and this is just basic teaching, beginning with the Buddha. So in the initial stage, there's what's called the preliminary sign. So you're bringing your attention, let's say, to the breath, and it's very unsteady, and so you have to keep bringing it back, and you lose it, and you bring it back, and you lose it. And this initial stage is called preliminary concentration, right? So you're developing your preliminary samadhi. And the breath is called the preliminary sign. Sign here, and it generally refers to something that has a quality. Okay, so the sign here is that which you're focusing on, something tangible, the breath. Okay, so that's you're developing your preliminary concentration. And as you're doing that, he says, once the initial excitement subsides, and excitement here is not all good, right? Excitement means just all kinds of activity. Active thoughts, fantasies, past thinking, future thinking, emotional states. I don't need to tell you, right? You know already. But as that begins to calm, right, which is a function of mindfulness, right, which is now, because in mindfulness you're holding that object, that preliminary sign, and in order to do that, all of that turbulence needs to be practiced skillfully so that we're gaining insight into it and to the self. We're actually resolving things, right, which does not happen when we suppress things. Nothing gets resolved. We're not letting go when we suppress anything. Right, we're guaranteeing that it's going to return. It's going to continue to have power. And so that whole process is working together to calm and release and clarify and resolve a lot of the things that we've been carrying for so many years. And he says, and then the mind begins to settle into the practice, into the actual practice. And then he says, here the five hindrances are likely to arise. So the initial excitement we can think of as just white noise. Just blah. As that begins to, because that's just like filling the screen. As that begins to subside, then the five hindrances are likely to arise. Now these are the much deeper karmic streams. And the five hindrances specifically are ill will and the whole family of anger and resentment and impatience and irritation, hatred, desire, and that whole family, everything that is wanting. Heaviness of mind, Bhikkhu Bodhi speaks about it. Often it's described as sloth, dullness, deadness, agitation, and this is restlessness, anxiety, worry, and doubt. And doubt here usually refers to doubts in the three treasures. We should include self-doubt because that's so prominent in our culture. It's interesting that the Sanskrit word for doubt literally means without medicine. So you could think of trust as having medicine. Kind of nice. And he says these hindrances pose a formidable barrier, but with practice and sustained effort, they will subside. Right? They will calm. And now the language, he says they will be overcome to conquer them. And so in the Mahayana, you'll see that same language, but that can be very dangerous because that can just sort of tie in with our sense of just subduing, extinguishing, sitting on, pushing down. And so we have to just keep remembering that letting go needs to be real letting go. And we've already talked about a lot of the different strategies that we need to employ. We talked about that last time. What are the various ways in which we move towards letting go? He says, as we go on the path of concentration, the process activates the five mental factors. And so these are initial application, which is the ability to the initial application, sustained application of mind, rapture, happiness, and one-pointedness. And so initial application is where we bring our attention to the object of attention, And it says it takes the mind, lifts it up, and drives it into the object the way one drives a nail through a block of wood. And so it's being able to really hold that awareness. This done, he says, sustained application of mind anchors the mind in the object, keeping it there through its function of examination. So it's much more grounded. And this is where words begin to fail. So there's, you could think of initial application as just being able to bring the attention to the breath and keep it there. But then something begins to happen in that sustained application, that sustained effort, in which there's an experience of groundedness, right? That's not just in your mind, but it's your whole being. It's your whole world. The universe becomes much more stable, more grounded. And that is, it does have a transformative experience, right? It changes how we experience things, but it also is impermanence. Impermanent, right? He says, to clarify the difference between these two applications of mind, initial application is compared to the striking of a bell, and sustained application is to the reverberations. So initial is just that first moment of contact, and then sustained is holding it through those reverberations. So these are mental factors that arise. And then rapture is the delight and joy that accompanies a favorable interest in the object. And so he uses the example of, you know, being in a desert, dying of thirst, and then you see an oasis. And that feeling of delight, of joy, right? So that's rapture. And then happiness is when you're actually drinking, right? And so again, you can think of these as just different qualities, aspects of the much deeper and genuine pleasure that arises when we reclaim our natural mind. And so this goes back, in a sense, to one aspect, at least, of what you were saying, that these, and it's okay to experience this, you know. Sometimes we can be so bent on letting go that we sort of rush past and don't allow ourselves to experience and be encouraged by those experiences. Or, of course, on the other side, we just get lost in them and we want to make that home. And then the fifth is one-pointedness. So all of these are now being developed. And he talks about how each of these sort of is a kind of antidote to the hindrances that we're working with at the same time. And then he gets into talking about access, concentration, and absorption concentration. And again, this language, you don't see it in the Zen tradition. So for various reasons, we can be sure of, even if we don't know why, the practitioners and teachers who were encountering the Dharma through this language did not continue to sort of utilize that in a lot of their expressed teachings. With the strengthening of concentration, that original object, the breath, gives rise to what he calls a learning sign. And again, these are just different sort of nuances of the development of concentration. And so this is where if your attention is to the breath, or if you're holding a mental image, you could also think of a visualization. If you're visualizing something, that there's a maturation or a kind of development or evolution, you could say, where that object, whatever it is, in the beginning is very weak, and keeps falling apart. And then we get to the point where we can hold it, but there's still a kind of distance. It's not breaking apart in the same way, but it's still kind of abstract and distant. And then that begins to shift, and it becomes much more, much stronger, more stable. And there's a shift where that object begins to, particularly if it's something that you're focusing on outside of yourself, visually, for instance, where now you would lower your eyes, and now you're holding it in your mind. So you're not relying upon a visual or a concrete object anymore. Now your concentration is sufficient that you can actually hold that in your mind. And so think about how the same process is happening in working with the breath. Even though from the very beginning the breath is not something you're focusing on visually, it's not, you know, intellectually it's not something that is outside of you, although oftentimes it feels very far away. And so what is that process that is happening in the same way, but you might experience a little bit differently with the breath? And so access concentration is sort of a stage where the mind is drawing closer to absorption. He says it's entering the neighborhood, which he says is a possible definition of the Sanskrit term for absorption. So now you're in the neighborhood. And then absorption is where that sense of distance really now begins to drop away, right? And with it, which means the different aspects of awareness of you and meditation and practicing and time and space. And so if you think about the role of stillness involved in this, right? Even though stillness itself also needs to be transcended, we cannot be dependent on physical stillness. How important that is, that's part of the conducive environment, right? And so in our training, we enter into that stillness from the very beginning, right? So we ask everybody to be physically still, which doesn't mean you are, right? Because even if you are really still, there's still a lot of movement, right? There's tension. There's subtle shifts, you know, just as you're trying to learn how to be in a good posture, right? There's very discrete forms of movement, which is part of the process of learning how to enter into that state of concentration with the mind and the body as a unified whole. And that when we move, right? So when we hear a sound, we get distracted. When we move, we get distracted. When somebody next to us moves, we get distracted, right? And so that, and we can get upset with that. And so in a sense, the liveness of the Zendo in the beginning can be a distraction, but it's actually helping you to be less dependent on a controlled state and a lack of any kind of anything, any kind of movement or sound or stimulation, so that that's no longer an obstruction. If you use it that way. Right? If you just get upset and you know, complain and moan and wish that person would stop swallowing, then it's not going to help you much. He says these two stages of concentration are differentiated neither by the absence of the hindrances nor by the counterpart sign, which is the object. These are common to both. In other words, they're not dependent on being absolutely absent of any hindrance. Doubt, anger, desire, restlessness. What differentiates them is the strength of the jhana factors, the meditation factors, which has a very specific meaning. Thus, the mind in this stage is compared to a child who has just learned to walk. You take a few steps, you fall down. You get up, you take a few more steps, you fall down. You get up, but you're wobbling, right? We're standing, but we're wobbling. And so, but in absorption, he says, it's like a person, you just walk. You're just walking without hesitation. And then the Buddha goes on to describe, and so now you're entering into what the Buddha called levels of jhana. Right, which are specific states of concentration. And this also goes back a little bit to what Taikyo was saying. And so in each of these stages, there are different elements that are present. And so in the first jhana, the Buddha says there is initial and sustained application, rapture and happiness. And then what happens is that in each successive stage, which is the development of the meditation and deepening concentration, is that sense of application of the mind begins to fall away. That sense of you are concentrating. That sense of you are focusing on this object. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra of 8,000 lines, the Buddha says, the Bodhisattva does not think, I am meditating. Right? There's just this. And then what happens as they continue is that rapture begins to fall away. Happiness begins to fall away. And so we're letting go of these pleasurable states, which are indicative of the practices developing. So they're good signs, but they're also impermanent, and they're conditioned, right? They're a result of our meditation. And they're also, if we dwell in them, they will obstruct us, right? And so sometimes people, I think, misunderstand this to mean that we're trying to get to a state where you never experience anything pleasurable, which is not true. This is about developing your meditation in such a way to move more and more towards that state of deep concentration and really leaping beyond knowing. And then those four states lead to four immaterial states, which I spoke about a few minutes ago. He says these are attained not by refining the mental factors, which is a more conscious process within the earlier stage, but by replacing a relatively gross object, like the breath, with a much subtler object, like infinite space. These states represent levels of concentration so subtle and remote as to elude clear verbal explanation. He says, but even so, these absorptions reached by the path of shamatha or serenity meditation, as exalted as they are, still lack the wisdom of insight. And so then he goes on to talk about how, he says, these concentration forms of concentration arise by fixing the mind upon a single object. But apart from these, there is another kind of concentration, which is, does not depend upon restricting the range of awareness. This is called momentary concentration. To develop this, the meditator does not deliberately attempt to exclude the multiplicity of phenomena from your field of attention. Instead, you simply direct mindfulness to the changing states of mind and body, noting any phenomenon that arises, and the task is to maintain a continuous awareness of whatever enters your range of perception. And as you do that, the concentration becomes stronger and stronger until it eventually establishes one pointedly on this constantly changing stream of events. And basically what's happening is this state of unification and entering into a state of suchness. And so again, Dogen says, elements come together and form this body. At the time of appearing, I don't say I appear. You're not identifying. You're not labeling. You're not dividing. The mind is no longer discriminating. It's not differentiating. At the time of disappearing, I don't say, that is, the meditator doesn't say, I disappear. It is not the self. In stillness, this is also Dogen in Bendoa, in stillness, mind and object merge in realization. Mind and object, subject and object, self and other, merge in realization and go beyond enlightenment, vipassana and shamatha. Silence and activities, stillness and movement. Merge in realization and go beyond enlightenment. Nevertheless, in the state of receptive samadhi, without disturbing its quality or moving a single particle, you engage the vast Buddha activity, the extremely profound and subtle Buddha transformation. Grasses, trees, lands, which are embraced by this transformation together, radiate a great light and endlessly expound the inconceivable, profound Dharma. As Bhikkhu Bodhi said, these states are so subtle and remote as to elude clear verbal explanation. So in the traditional path of insight meditation, there are conceptual practices where you examine the skandhas, form, sensation, feeling, conception, the mind beginning to form words, discrimination, where you see you're studying your mind developing into a state of consciousness around something that's arisen. And so you bring, so that becomes an object of your concentration, right? That becomes a meditation unto itself. And the analysis, in this sense of analytic meditation, is not, you know, narrating, but you're directing your attention to see its impermanence, to see that in that form, in that feeling, as you hold that in a very strong state of concentration, you can't find, if it's a feeling, a sensation of pain, that you can't find pain in it. That if you, if there's a sense that this is you, right, you are this, that as you hold that sensation or that aggregate in your mind, you can't find self. You can't find I. I am not appearing in this as it leaves. I am not disappearing. And so in the Zen tradition, this is happening, right? But it's happening inclusively. The Buddha, Dogen says, when you sit even for a moment upright in samadhi, expressing the Buddha mudra, this is the Buddha mudra, in the three activities of body, speech, and thought, the whole world of phenomena becomes the Buddha's seal, and the entire sky turns into enlightenment. And so what he's saying is that from the very beginning, in each and every moment, you have arrived. Each and everything that appears is this Buddha mudra. Our sense of things as being deluded and enlightened, being skillful and unskillful, there is a skillfulness in seeing that, right? So that we can let go of what we need to let go of and strengthen what we need to strengthen. But we should know that we are using a mental construct, right, in order to ultimately let go of that construct. The Zen tradition basically says, rather than go through different rooms, you enter into this room, and then you move into the next room, and then you move into the next room. There's just one room. There's just one room. You're in it. And so the challenge of that is revealing that to yourself, having that revealed to you. And so the power of it is revealing that to yourself. And so, again, I think, you know, what I would like to emphasize is that in studying this and continuing to study, it's not over, right? That you reflect on what you're studying and just think about, okay, having faith that whatever you're studying is part of your practice already, to some degree. How do you see that? Right? How can you relate to what you're studying and see that in your practice? And even having that awareness, even just conceptually in your mind, can help you to recognize it. Right? I mean, the moment you begin sitting, you're seeing impermanence. But do we recognize it in the beginning? No, we don't. We see things come and go, but we're not recognizing that as impermanence. And I think that's the importance of this, is and the marrying together of understanding with direct practice, right? And particularly, I think that's important for us as Zen practitioners, is that. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I spoke most of this session. There's just a lot to do.
So in our ongoing conversation of It's All One Dharma, I think this first time I hear you. So I hope I hear you. So in Dogen talking about the great mudra, so in speaking of language, so Taikyo's question, instead of speaking of it as letting go, since there's nothing really to let go, and that's where I get confused, why not talk about it the way you just did, which is ferociousness or misery or hatred and anger, that the five poisons are the five wisdoms, that it's all suchness, so that when the feeling of that we all can't, you know, we all get uncomfortable, but to see it as nothing to let go of, but to just recognize with our mind that it's all suchness. For me, that language becomes so freeing.
Yeah, but you're hearing that as a practitioner of how many years?
Don't go there.
But what I'm saying is that means to you. I mean, to talk about suchness was, I mean, I heard my teacher talking about suchness for years. I had no idea what he was talking about. I didn't know what he was talking about. I sure as hell understood letting go. Okay. That made sense to me.
Okay. That helps.
And we do qualify that. So in beginning instruction, for instance, something arises, you let it go, it returns. Okay, so now practice letting go by not letting go. Right, so that we're clear that we are still on this path of non-attachment, of non-reification, of I am not appearing, right? But something's here, and it's taking up all the space, right? And to me, it's very real. It is a thing, and it's doing something to me, right? All of that is my actual experience. And so I think that language, any language, is both true and false at the same time. Right? If it's good dharma, it is saying something that's true, and it's pointing us and guiding us in the right direction, and it's also adding something that is not true, just by virtue of it being expressed. Okay? Because that's our relationship with language. We hear something, and it becomes something in our mind, right? But that's just a part of the process. You know, and so, but I think when we talk about, you know, we often talk about it in terms of pain, but whether it's anger or lust or whatever it is, and we see very quickly how we can't just let go of an emotion. Clearly, that's a different kind of species of thing arising, different than a thought. And so we realize, we discover, we have to practice letting go, whatever that is, liberating ourselves, right, or just not strengthening this, in a different kind of way, right, and that's also why, as Bhikkhu Bodhi says, you know, as the Buddha says, as Buddhism says, that having direct guidance is so important, right, so that. You know, when I'm sitting in front of somebody who's talking about something, you know, I can see there's no point in talking about the emptiness of this, because this is not empty for this person. It's a living, breathing dragon, right? So let's face it that way, right? And then in practicing it, something happens, something is happening, right? They're experiencing that thing which a moment ago was so real and intractable, and now they can't find it. So what's that about? And when we experience that, and even then we don't recognize it. You know, we're just glad it's gone. But we don't really see what's happening, right? And that's not our fault. We're not seeing what's happening because our mindfulness and concentration is not developed along with our understanding to allow us to actually see what we're seeing. And that's what's hard to describe. You know, because if we think of it in terms of our normal senses, if you see something, you see it. You know, if you look at a book, you're looking at a book. Right? What's so complicated? But this kind of seeing is not like that. And yet, I think we're experiencing the truth of that at every step along the way. You know, how, I mean, the moment you start sitting, you're having experience, right? You're having direct experience. And with time, that begins to become known, understood. And that's why, you know, we can hear a teaching that we've heard many times before, and it's like, oh, why didn't you tell me this before? You know? Now we hear it. And we're not just hearing it, right? We're experiencing the truth of that. And there just isn't a shortcut to that, you know? We have to go, that's these stages. I mean, even though, you know, Zen basically says, it's all here, sit down, and it is fully manifest. But that doesn't mean that we're going to experience that full manifestation. And Dogen knows that. He knows that. He just wants us to, he wants to present that larger view, right? So that we can hold that up together with our more limited view.
When the Buddha departed from the Samadhi Shamatha practitioners that he had excelled with that practice, he then went on to solve the problem. The question is, did he go out of that frame of reference into a specific kind of practice? Or is what he did after that just so hard to describe that we can't really?
He describes it. I mean, remember too that he then spent these years with these ascetics and practicing meditation and, you know, developing this incredibly powerful concentration, you know, vis-a-vis these very extreme ascetic practices. And so, which he eventually rejected, but what he walked away with was the development of that meditation that he'd been developing to withstand the extremities that he was putting himself through. And so, but then he rejected that because he realized how extreme it was and that that wasn't sustainable, and it couldn't be liberation, right? Because how could you sustain that? And so, but I think then when he sat down and he had a sense of what he needed to do. And so he talks about, he directed his mind. He at that moment, he and whatever else was present was both the student and the teacher. And in a sense, in our own more humble ways, we're doing the same thing. You know, we are learning how to be, hopefully continue to be the student, but also become more and more of our own guide. You know, as we're developing and understanding, that's the whole point, right, is that we're able to guide ourselves more and more. And you know that, because you speak to me about it all the time, right? You don't say it that way, you just show it to me.
Thank you.
Roshi, Would you say something about developing the strength of concentration in the one-pointed sort of koan practice way of one-pointedness and the practice of Shinkantaza, where we realize the open sky?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's essentially what, you know, Bhikkhu Bodhi was saying in a different way. To develop momentary concentration, the meditator doesn't deliberately attempt to exclude anything, the multiplicity of phenomena. Instead, you simply direct mindfulness to the changing states of mind and body. And when I teach Shikantaza, I don't even say that you're not directing your attention to anything, right? To changing states of body or non-changing states of body. You're just aware, just awareness. That is the whole world, because it is the whole world. And so really you're sitting in mind. You're not even sitting in mind. You're just mind. That's the room. And then you're trying to stay true to that, in a sense. Don't distort that. Don't create a sense that as phenomena has arisen, that you've somehow left that room. Or that somehow this is another mind that has arisen. Or that somehow this is a dividing or an obstruction. And because we've had so many years and years and years of experience of these things arising as being obstructions, it's hard. We keep falling into that. We keep being seduced and seeing them. And that's why it can't just be conceptual. We have to also be experiencing the impermanence, the permeability, the you know, emptiness.
I think something that comes up for me often is working with that open mind, looking at whatever arises, and having some idea about wanting to strengthen my concentration.
I know.
Or strengthen my experience of doing that, or to do it better somehow.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what right effort looks like in that context.
Well, let me just say it this way, that, you know, when somebody has a very slight aspiration or motivation or bodhicitta, it's there, but it's not very strong, then that's part of their work, is to try and cultivate that, strengthen that, right? And we've talked about that a lot over this series. There's in different ways about cultivating that. When people have a very strong bodhicitta, that is a powerful force. And it can guide us and propel us forward, but it can sure as hell obstruct us as well. Because we want something. And so that wanting has to become a central, we have to understand that. We have to really see it clearly. Because in general, we only see it as good. Because it's bodhicitta, for Christ's sake. Right? It's wanting liberation. How is that not good? Right? It is good, but there's something in it that isn't. It's bodhicitta itself is good. So what else are we bringing into it? What else is there? And for some people, that's a hard road to give up. Because it's hard to trust. Because the feeling is, if I really trust these teachings and I really let go, I'm not going to accomplish. Right? Because that's how you accomplish something, is by grabbing the bull by the horn and not letting it throw you off. Maybe one more, Chinchin.
So, you mentioned that momentary concentration is like Shikantaza, but then, so koan studies, how does that relate to to this whole thing.
Yeah, so koan is an object, right? And so if a student is working on mu, for instance, which is both as hard and as easy as it gets, hard because it's the first koan, and easy because it's just mu, that's why it is so traditionally and sort of predominantly the first koan, is because it is so object-like. But there's another element to it, right, which is the question. And so that question, too, becomes part of the object of your concentration. So everything that we've been talking about is completely present. It's just the object now is this koan, which is not a thing, right? So you experience it as a sound, you experience it as a question, let all of your spiritual hunger be infused into it, and you're developing your concentration in it, so you're holding, when your mind gets distracted, you bring back. But it also is bringing you into that non-conceptual insight, right? And it does that in a very particular way, right? It's using your doubt, your spiritual doubt, which is needs to be present in a sense at all times, but we're not necessarily putting it in front of us. With the koan, it's right there. And so that hunger, that desire, is part of what you're holding and learning how to hold, so it doesn't eat you up. It doesn't become an obstruction or, you know, something that, you know, you're fixated on. But at the same time, is giving you urgency. And that ultimately, as you go through these stages, in that sense of, you know, access, concentration, absorption, where you're merging, right? But not just merging and absorption, because that's samadhi, there's no insight there. But in a very particular way, I would even say peculiar way, the question, right? So there's still something in your consciousness. The question that you're bringing into it is what allows it to not just become stuck in absorption, but to bring about insight, but in a way that's not conceptual. And that's where trying to explain it becomes impossible. That is the koan work itself, right? And that's why the teacher, there's not a lot the teacher can do. I mean, in the first couple doksans, I pretty much said all I can say. I just keep saying it over and over, right? It's really the student that's working this out.
Thank you.
Okay, so we did not at all exhaust this subject. And I'm glad for that. So, thank you. I hope this was helpful. And please do continue. You know, I was saying to somebody earlier, it's kind of interesting that the Eightfold Path is so central, you know, so seminal, in that there are some books written on it, but not like a million. And rather, I think most of the teachings on the Eightfold Path are just absorbed within, embedded within teachings. You know, that sometimes they're speaking about them directly, and sometimes they're just speaking about them as aspects of practice, right? And that's an important part of studying them, is that then you see, you can recognize that in this moment they're talking about effort, even if they're not using the word, right? Or they're talking about intention or right understanding. Okay. So, thank you, everybody. Can we end with our vows?
Thanks for listening. Do you have physical challenges to visiting Zen Mountain Monastery or Fire Lotus Temple? The Diamond Net is a group of Mountains and Rivers Order students who are available to support your practice. We provide Dharma and other support to Sangha members facing life challenges such as illness or mobility issues. If you would like to visit the monastery or the Zen Center but need some physical help, someone from the Diamond Net can assist you. For information, email diamondnet@mro.org or visit our webpage at zmm.org and look under the Programs menu.